welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of this Tuesday edition. Today is Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015, just a few days before Christmas here. And just for you folks out there, in case you haven't heard our schedule for this week, we will be off on Christmas Eve, and we will be solo, flying solo on Blog Talk Radio, going back to our roots, as my dad has been saying the last few days, on Christmas Day from 7 to 10. Blog Talk Radio, accessible only.
Yeah.
Just like we used to do it. Yeah. There you go. Push that. So we're going
to. That's the way to do it. You cough, and then, or you push the cough button on, and then cough. Excuse me.
But we will be on Blog Talk Radio exclusively on Christmas night from 7 to 10. Just me and my dad, and I think. I don't know if we determined this yet, but we're going to be doing the year in review from
that's
last year.
Yeah, we're going to do that full boat. If you remember, listeners might remember last year, it was one of the days toward the end of the year. It might have been the New Year's Eve, who people called in and said, well, this is what I think is going to happen in 2015. And we're going to take those, dust those off out of the safe, you know, take them out of the file cabinet, and take a look and see. Those who called in and sent in emails, who was correct? Or, you know, who was closest? Pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to give any hints. Not going to do it. Ain't going to do it. All right. So.
We got news.
Yep.
We got.
Oh, before we do, I'm going to make somehow. You know what? Portions of tonight's broadcast brought to you by AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. You know, things will get bad. Do I need to talk you into? I'm not going to even try. If you don't want to prep, don't prep. Okay, don't. If you don't. I mean, I'm not going to talk you into it.
Or if you can't.
No, I mean, if you can't, no, I understand that, but
you won't. You can't.
But any purchase is made at American Survival Wholesale, and they're our go-to company. Look, there are so many survival wholesale companies out there. There are so many types of freeze-dried storable food. I've had more than I care to even try. I've had enough. I really have. Try this. Try that. Here, have some of this, and. It ranges from cardboard sawdust tasting to pretty good. Good, actually. I mean, not just not bad, but good. American Survival Wholesale through their Thrive brand, and they've got the best tasting, in my view, food. Whether it's chicken, and I had some pretty bad chicken. I mean, I didn't think you could screw chicken up. Pretty bad, you know, but they've got their freeze-dried chicken tastes fresh. It really does, and it's really good. The same with their fruits and vegetables and everything. So American Survival Wholesale is our go-to company. AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com, and for now and for the foreseeable future, until further notice, you buy anything there, and they'll give you a coupon code $50 off the ticket price. We're here at the Watchman Conference. Pretty cool,
can't
huh?
Beat that.
Pretty cool, eh?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's that. And healthmasters.com. Healthmasters, just a tremendous, boy, tremendous nutritional supplements. Plus the newsletter, healthmasters.com newsletter. Tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. Healthmasters.com for all of your nutritional needs. I've seen the videos of their laboratories, and I guess they would be called laboratories where you know make the capsules and what have you. It's fascinating to see it. The machines are like just to make those little capsules, you know, put the mm-hmm. stuff in and put them together. It's like $2 million.
And so before cool. I forget, yep. tomorrow, Steve Quayle will be on. We'll be yep. interviewing him about his new book.
Empire Beneath the Ice, How the Nazis Won World War II.
And then next week, we have Monday open for right now. Tuesday, we have...
I think we might be keeping some of these days open. That's Tuesday.
We
slant.
I don't know. I think I told you this.
No, you didn't.
Brother Marcus's son Curtis.
Yes, you did.
Contacted us today. He's going to be coming on Tuesday from 7 to 7:30.
Just to give us an update of what's going on with him.
Yeah, and you know, he's been doing. He's had a lot of life changes in the last 6 months.
Yes.
Brother Marcus passed away. He was a close friend of ours. Close friend of mine, you know.
Yeah.
Think about him all the time. And him and Curtis did Pine Ridge Warriors radio show. And he's going to come on and tell us how he's doing and what he's doing as he's continuing the ministry that him and his father started, which will be great to hear from him. It was today when I got a chance to talk to him. And then we have Nathan coming on Wednesday for a year in review show next Wednesday. So we're going to have some pretty good shows from Steve to Curtis to Nathan.
Steve, tomorrow it's going to be a little bit different because I told Steve, I said, Steve, I want to ask you specific questions. I mean, I got like, I kind of want to give an overview, at least initially, or have him. And we talked about the overview. Because we need to understand, and this, I really think, what we're seeing today, right now, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Ukraine, and especially in those areas, or even in the United States, we're seeing this ideology and of the Nazi ideology. And let me tell you something. I was brought to this point, kicking and screaming, thinking, now this is kind of all bogus and. You know, you watch enough shows on the History Channel about Hitler and about the Nazis. You know, it's like, I know, and you're taught in school about them. And really, what do the Nazis today have to do with the price of tea in the supermarket? Okay, or whatever. Oh, wait a minute, a whole lot, because Russ Dizdar gets into this. And now everything, it's the questions that I had and my inability to connect certain dots it's like a world opened up. After reading Steve's book, and I immediately did not get it after reading Steve's book. I was reading Hitler's Legacy by Lavenda, and I was reading that. I was reading Ratline at the same time. I'm one for having two or three books going at the same time.
Yeah.
And I had a whole bunch of notes written down, and then I was reading Steve's, and then I went back to and I don't know what I was doing, and all of a sudden it hit me. I said, wait a minute, okay, we're seeing this alliance, this triple alliance forming in the Middle East and even in Ukraine, or all throughout the what was the previously the Ottoman Empire. And then we're seeing the technology rise to the level now of, well, some of the shows like Hellboy and the portals and even CERN, how CERN is connected to this, or the technology from CERN is connected to this. And then, you know, we have a gentleman like researcher Matt Peterson on talking about biblical and occult numerology, or biblical numerology, I'm just going to say numerology, numbers, the importance of numbers, and saying, look at all these 11s, look at all these numbers popping up, or whatever the number might be. It shows a divine fingerprint, number one, but number two, it also shows a force, and that being the Nazi force, the members of the Vreeland Thule or Thule Society, depending on your pronunciation preference, Blavatsky, Bailey, all those people adhering to the Nazi ideology and infusing that ideology into the domestic situation here into the United States, combined with what can be what I would deem as the Tavistockian or Tavistock Institute, Tavistockian ideology, which borrows heavily from the Nazi ideology. Or there's a symbiotic relationship there, into the social engineering of the people of the West. It's kind of like we're getting hit from all sides. It really is. Mm-hmm. And there was something I was going to go through, but I don't necessarily. Well, let me just see something here. And folks, you can do this as a homework assignment. Let me. Um, got to go back to the Korean War. Think about this. Go back to the Korean War. Just follow me on this, and I'm going to circle back around here to the current day. If you remember in history books, after the Korean War ended, well, even during the Korean War, American prisoners of war were coming back, and they were spouting off all sorts of bizarre pro-communist statements after being taken to Manchuria as prisoners. You remember reading about this? Well, they were being subjected to mind control, subjected to torture and mind control. One thing outside of the topics of conversation, and I see this taking place today, or at least the artifacts of it taking place today, whether it be the shootings or maybe mass casualty events or Sirhan Sirhan or the Manson family, Charlie Manson. What do all these things have in common? There was, in case you didn't catch this, there was this car occupied, and Joe, you've got the story on this. It was by a black woman in Las Vegas. She took her car and she ran over 37 people. Interesting number. Killed one. We have it on our website where there's the reports of that she said Allahu Akbar, you know, when she ran over. That's rumor, speculation. That's not confirmed, or that's at least allegedly from at least one witness. But put that aside for a moment. Just put it aside for a moment. Because one thing we're seeing is a thread, and I believe this to be true, based on a lot of research. And this is the kind of research where you're reading and you go to bed. You might wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You can go to your office. You shut the door. You grab a cup of coffee. And then you read from 3 to 6 in the morning and then go back to bed. Come back. And you do it again. There's the thread. There's this thread that we've seen really since the early 20th century. And that's the thread of mind control. Mind control based on trauma, childhood trauma, based on trauma induced. Russ Dizdar talks about this. Paul McGuire talks about this. And we could be talking about, again, I had mentioned Sirhan Sirhan, I mentioned others, but including the Manson, but what about Mark David Chapman and all of the other people, Hinckley? These mass murderers, the Aurora, Colorado shooter, ostensibly. Isn't there something funny about all of this, including the latest, that being the Las Vegas hit-and-run person? Something weird about all of this. Really. Even the most hardened skeptic, I believe, would say, man, there's just something really strange about this. Well, and I think there is. So, you know what? We're not going to have time to get into this. We'll talk maybe a little bit about this tomorrow. This involves psychological warfare specialists who were involved in the CIA. They were involved in the Nazis. Were involved in many areas. I mean, we're talking about some pretty sick individuals, sick scientists, sick people. And using the fruits of the Nazi experimentation, the OSS and CIA had used and exploited that information and created these Manchurian candidates, a reference, of course, to Manchuria, you know, Manchuria or Korean War, and I do believe that we're seeing this take place, and at the epicenter of this is the Tavistock Institute. If you really want to understand social engineering today, if you really want to understand what's really taking place with respect to how you're being gamed and we're being gamed and how we're being hypnotized by the shiny little trinkets out there, this is the Tavistock Institute. And there are a couple of people who are responsible for this. And you could do your own research on this. John Rees, R-E-E-S, was one of them. Head of the Tavistock. And then you had different different mind control programs that stemmed from Operation Bluebird. More on that in a different program. If you're interested in hearing it, let me know by send me an email. Studio at HagmanHagman.com if you're interested in that, understanding that.
Now, you have a audio you want to
yeah.
play.
Folks, I mentioned it in the first hour. This is important, okay? I'm not really keen on what congressmen and senators say because we know they're all bought, paid for, and compromised. But occasionally you find a good piece of audio. Occasionally you find something that really kind of knocks your socks off. And so you say, wait a minute, man. He's right. He's actually telling the truth. There's a moment of congressional lucidity there. How'd that happen? Might not last long, but it's there. This is a freshman senator who's going to be talking here. It's worth the listen. It's 15 minutes. If you're joining us now, please don't leave us. Listen to this. Because I think you're going to... This guy says what I wish I would have said, okay? And I could say, but he's going to say it. So there you have it. But listen to what he's going to say. It's about Trump and it's about Obama. But listen carefully and you'll know, I think at the end, you'll know why that we wanted this to play. If you're watching this on YouTube, it'll be on YouTube. If you're listening to this on radio, just listen to it. It doesn't matter. You're going to see either the guy, the congressman, or the senator, that is, or you're just going to be looking at the road or whatever you're doing. Maybe you might be hunting wild boar. Who knows? just have a listen. Here it goes.
Mr. President, today I'd like to propose a thought experiment. Imagine President Trump has been propelled into the White House with 300 electoral votes, having won mainly by the force of his personality, by calling BS on this town, and by his promise to get things done by acting unilaterally. The first 100 days are huge. He signs an order that turns the Peace Corps into stonemasons to build the Southern Wall. He shutters the Department of Education, and by executive order, he turns the Department of Interior into the classiest oil company the world has ever known. What happens next? Would those who've stayed silent about executive overreach over the last 7 years suddenly find religion? After years of legislative atrophy, would Congress spring into action and remember its supposed power of the purse? And what about Republicans? After having raged against a supposedly lawless president, would many suddenly find that they're actually okay with a strongman president so long as he's wearing the same colored jersey they are? He may be a lawless son of a gun, some of them would say, but he's our lawless son of a gun. Would the ends justify the means? The way that Congress thinks and talks about executive power over the last few years has been almost this sophomoric. It has been based overwhelmingly on the party tag of whoever happens to sit in the Oval Office at any given moment. Republicans, Democrats, us versus them. These are the political trenches, and the no man's land lies somewhere between this chamber and 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. When your highest objective is advancing partisan lines on a map, it's easy to forgive a president who oversteps his authority so long as he's your guy and the one with authority is in your party. Mr. President, I would suggest that this is the entirely wrong way to think about this issue. The problem of a weak Congress, which we are, and the growth of the unchecked executive should be bad news to all of us. But more importantly than us, this should be bad news for every constituent who cast their votes for us under the impression that the Congress actually makes decisions, doesn't just offer whiny suggestions. The shrinking of the legislature in the age of Obama should be bad news for all of us for three reasons. First, we've taken an oath to defend the Constitution, and the Constitution invests the legislature with the legislative powers. Second, the founders' design of checks and balances actually was and is a good idea. They were struggling to preserve the freedom of the individual and especially of the vulnerable against the powerful, against those who could afford to hire the well-connected lobbyists. The founders were equally afraid of the unchecked consolidation of power in a king or in the passions of a mob. They understood that human nature means that those in power will almost always try to grab more power, and that base reality hasn't changed over the last 230 years. Third, under the system that is now emerging, the public is growing more and more frustrated. They think that most of us will be reelected no matter what, and they think that the executive agencies that daily substitute rulemaking for legislating will promulgate whatever rules they want no matter what, and the people have no control. People grow more cynical in a world where the legislators, who can be fired, that's what elections are for, have little actual power, and in a world where the bureaucrats, who have most of the actual power, cannot be fired. It is basically impossible for the people who are supposed to be in charge in our system to figure out how they would throw the bums out. They ask, where is the accountability in the present arrangement? Let me be clear about two things up front. First, I think that the weakness of the Congress is not just undesirable, I think it's actually dangerous for America and her future. And second, I think this not because I am a Republican and we have a Democrat in the White House. Rather, I think this because I've taken an oath of office to a constitutional system, and I will continue to hold this view and have taken this oath the next time that a Republican president tries to reach beyond his or her constitutional powers. Despite these two strongly held views, though, in this series of addresses on the growth of the administrative state, and more broadly on the unbalanced nature of executive-legislative branch relations in our time, my goal will not be primarily to advocate. My first goal is just to do some history together. My goal is primarily to describe how the executive branch has grown and how presidents of both parties are guilty of it. But it isn't just that Republicans and Democrats are guilty of trying to consolidate more power when they have the presidency, although that is true, it is a one-way ratchet. It is also the case that Republicans and Democrats are to blame in this Congress for not wanting to lead on hard issues and take hard votes, but rather to sit back and let successive presidents gobble up more authorities. My goal is to give all of us who are called to serve in this body a shared sense of some historical moments about how we got to this place where so much of the legislative function now happens inside the executive branch, and to convince my colleagues of both parties that we have to take this power back, regardless of who serves in the White House and what party they are from. So how did we get to the place where so many giant legislative decisions are now made inside 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and in the dozens of alphabet soup agencies? To understand that, we have to look briefly at the founders and what they were trying to accomplish. These were educated men who had studied all forms of government throughout recorded human history. They had a worked-out theory of human nature. They knew that we are created with inherent dignity that is worthy of respect, that our rights come to us from God via nature, and that government doesn't give us rights. Government is just our shared tool to secure those natural rights. At the same time, they knew that we also have a disposition to self-interest and a capacity for evil. They observed that throughout all of human history, rulers tried to consolidate more power for their own ends, and this is obviously dangerous. One of the lessons they drew from their rich historical understanding was the importance of keeping the three main functions of government separate. As Montesquieu wrote, quote, "All would be lost if the same man or the same body of principal men, either of the nobles or of the masses, exercised these three powers, that of making the laws, that of executing them, and that of judging the crimes and the disputes among individuals." The separation of powers could not, of course, be absolute, for the branches had to work together. Each power had to counterpose one another. The key was to divide the power among different institutions while ensuring that those institutions could act together as a coherent whole on the basis of what they called mixed government. The Constitution that emerged from the founders' debates and deliberations intentionally enshrined this separation of the powers, and this was a direct result of the founders' study of human nature and their conclusion that that nature was relatively constant. Men everywhere tend to aggrandize power and to use it for selfish ends. When power checks power in the government, the people are better protected. As Tocqueville said when he studied America, their more constrained government leaves them more room for civil society. We have a limited government because we mean to enable nearly limitless, that is, more free families, more free inventors, more free churches and synagogues, more free not-for-profits, more free local governments, and so on. If you have to describe the essence of the American government in one sentence, Lincoln, to paraphrase him, said, "It is of the people, by the people, and for the people." Americans believe that we are free, endowed by our Creator with inalienable, that is, unchangeable and untouchable rights. And that is the opposite of pretty much everything the world had ever held in government until 1776. This is what American exceptionalism means. Not that there's something unique about Americans, distinct from people of any other place, but that the American idea is premised on rejecting the idea that the king is the one who is free. The king, after all, had an army, and you didn't, and he could use his power however he wished. And his subjects, remember they were not called citizens, they were subjects, were dependent. If they wanted to open a business, to start a church, to publish a book, then they needed to ask the king for permission. All that was not mandatory was forbidden unless the king gave you an exception, unless the king gave you a carve-out, unless the king gave you a waiver. In America, the opposite was to be true. You are born free, regardless of where you're from or who your parents are, regardless of your bank balance or the color of your skin. In America, if you want to preach a sermon or write a piece of investigative journalism, if you want to say that your elected leaders are losers, if you want to invest in a new app or to launch a nonprofit, in America, you don't need the king's permission, for you are free. About 100 years ago, this idea, our system of separation of powers, came under attack. There are three or four large reasons why the era of urbanization and industrialization and then progressivism and the rise of specialized experts called our constitutional system of limited government into question, and we will tackle some of those topics after the holidays. But for now, it is sufficient to say that the presidency began to grow larger in the first two decades of the 20th century, and the Congress began to lose some of its powers. It happened because presidents of both parties were willing to overreach, and because the Congress was willing to underreach, to retreat from that field of competitive ideas, to retreat from our constitutional commitments. For every TR, Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, there is an FDR, a Democrat. This should not be a partisan issue, for both sides have been guilty of extensive executive branch overreach. Meanwhile, the professional legislators realized that permanent incumbency is easier if you cede control rather than lead, if you decide not to take the hard votes, but just quietly ask the executive branch to make the decisions unilaterally. Today, many in my party argue that no president has ever even contemplated doing what President Obama regularly does. That's actually not true. Whatever one might think about President Obama's gobbling up of powers, his theories are not at all new. His theories date back to the Progressive Era's disdain for the limits of the Constitution, and this is especially evident in the self-conscious executive expansionism of Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican, and Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat. After the holidays, we're going to spend a little time exploring both of these men and their attempts to marginalize and to intentionally ignore the Congress to, as TR put it, quote, "greatly broaden the use of the executive power," close quote. I hope that this look at the rise of the executive branch and its legislating over the next number of months will contribute to our efforts, all of us here together who want to recover and safeguard that constitutional vision. But, Mr. President, in historical terms, the Congress in the age of Obama is very weak. This isn't about the current majority leader, and it isn't about the most recent previous majority leader. It is much bigger than that. This institution is arguably the weakest it has been relative to the executive branch at any point in our nation's 2.5 centuries. Others interested in the history of this special place might argue that there's some other moment with greater relative weakness than this current moment. We should have that debate, for we should be discussing how and why this institution became so weak. We should stop pretending the constant exaggeration that happens around here as people fake it, pretending that some tiny procedural vote that didn't pass somehow still changed the world. We should stop pretending omnicompetence across huge expanses of often unknowable executive branch governmental action. Voters, better, citizens, don't believe us. The lobbyists don't believe it either. They're willing to fake it with you, but they don't really believe you. Which is why so many lobbying firms today are expanding most of their efforts in the regulatory, not the legislative lobbying space, for that's where the action is. It would be far more useful in this body, not to mention far more believable to the people that we work for us to learn to talk openly about how and why this once powerful and still special body became so weak.
All right.
Congress
we're going to come back.
Is mocked.
We're going to come back. Go ahead and hit that. Okay, good. All right, Joe, I'm going to turn it to you in a second. There's just a couple of things I want to bring out here. Hopefully, ladies and gentlemen, you listened to what he had to say. Now, there's a lot not correct. Well, okay, there's a lot that he addresses on a microcosmic level that doesn't take in the big picture, but he is, number one, speaking, in my view, as a statesman. Number two, he's speaking with a certain level of decorum and dignity that Washington has not seen for some time. And number three, he's also addressing some of the issues of centralization and consolidation, which is a problem as it relates to our three branches of government. Now, he didn't quite hit, in my view, he could have gone a lot deeper and been a lot stronger with his assessments. He wasn't. But for those people who are still stuck in the fictitious right-left Republican-Democratic paradigm, who have not yet given up hope on the fact that we just have one party, and that's their party, not our party, that's them, not us, that's royalty versus the serfs, meaning us, then this should ring true. This should bring some people. And by the way, folks, this speech was last week. I think various websites, all a pundit, for example, for one. I got it directly. We got it from the senator's website directly. All right. And it goes on for another, I think, 12 minutes. But what I really want everyone to understand here is a lot of people are adhering and parroting and really celebrating Trump because he's not politically correct. Some say he's just correct. The question is not whether he's in my view, the question is not whether he is or should be or needs to be politically correct, nor is the question, is he correct? Because he is correct in many things that he says, but so was Hitler. You see, by consolidating the power into an executive branch and by weakening the legislative branch, which is the point of this, you breed tyrants. It doesn't matter if it's their tyrant or our tyrant, meaning the right-left paradigm. A tyrant is still a tyrant. I had this played, and I said all of that to say this. We are in a very perilous political situation right now that has taken really years and decades to develop. This was an intentional neutering of the legislative branch. We see it as the laws are now not only made by Congress, but they're made by the executive branch and they're made by the judicial branch, the weakest branch of all. And it's unconstitutional. and believing that the Constitution delineates rights bestowed upon us by Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Is it not, then, does it not follow, then, that we would be more correct to follow the tenets of the Constitution than just to be correct, but not politically correct, and to hell with the Constitution? The heck with being constitutionally correct. In other words, what I'm saying is, it sounds good, Trump. Oh. Hard to find arguments with Trump. But see, in post-World War I, pre-World War II Germany, it's hard to find arguments with Hitler as well. But that's talking around the subject. The subject at its core is who and what pushed the nations, the nation states, into the position where they embraced a personality and a leader, political leader like Hitler. That, to me, is the question. And that's where we are today. Joe.
Right on the money. All right. We got about 18 minutes before we take our top of the hour break, and then Stan will be joining us. Got some important news information I want to hit. First, we're going to hit this piece here. Virginia Attorney General unilaterally eliminates concealed carry reciprocity.
Reciprocity. Let's say it together.
I don't need help. I already did practices.
I know. I just kid him.
Reciprocity. I even have it.
Yeah, see me try to pronounce
Thessalonians.
Yeah, I can never say that.
The Virginia Attorney General announced Tuesday that he would unilaterally eliminate gun carry reciprocity agreements with 25 other states on February 1st, a move that will affect millions of Americans. What they're going to do, they had an agreement with 25 states. If you had a concealed carry permit, let's say in I don't have a list of the states here, in Pennsylvania, Virginia would honor that. Well, now the governor has revoked that, and is in to ensure Virginia's law and safety standards for concealed handgun permits are applied evenly, consistently, and fairly. I have recommended that the state police terminate the agreements of 25 states whose laws are not adequate to prevent issuance of a concealed handgun permit to individuals that Virginia would disqualify. Herring said. The state police has accepted the recommendation and has begun sending letters to the 25 states informing them, as of February 1st, their permits will no longer be recognized by Virginia. The move has been called a common sense step that it would make Virginia police safer. To me, this is a common sense step that can help make Virginians and our law enforcement officer safer by ensuring that our concealed carry laws and safety standards apply to everyone in Virginia, whether they are resident or visitor, he said. Strong, consistent enforcement of Virginia's laws and safety standards can prevent disqualified people who may be dangerous or irresponsible from utilizing a concealed handgun permit, and it's what the law requires.
Okay, what law is that? Now, is it codified state or commonwealth, because Virginia is a commonwealth. We have to make that distinction between states and commonwealths.
The Attorney General did not provide examples of those without a state carry permits who have committed gun crimes in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Right.
The Virginia State Police spokesman, Courtney Geller, said the department doesn't have any statistics on such crimes. They said she says this is not something we have been readily tracking. Now, they've determined...
So it's made out of whole cloth, basically.
There's 25 to 30 agreements with other states, and there is a list of states here.
And Pennsylvania is one. Yes.
See, folks, you can go to the Free Beacon to get a list of the states, but it goes into effect February 1st, 2016.
Right.
Virginians will not be able to carry in many of these states, and gun carry permit holders from these states will not be able to carry in Virginia. Only state permits... Virginia will continue to honor those from West Virginia, Michigan, Texas, and Utah.
Right.
Open carry without a permit by anyone who can legally possess a firearm will continue to be legal for both residents and non-residents. But agreements...
Why is this important to you?
Well, it's not important to me, but it is important to We see people that travel all the time.
But it should be. Go on.
I mean, I could... A law, just like a criminal, is a criminal going to leave their gun at, you know, outside of a gun-free zone just to
safe? I would hope so. I mean, look, you know.
We live in a lawless nation where violence has a tendency to happen from elementary schools to movie theaters to, you know,
anywhere. Here's why I think that this story is important, because what this governor is doing is...
It's opening a door.
Is opening a door. That's correct. And although other states obviously don't have to follow, but what is taking place here is you've got a governor that is acting as, as usurping the Second Amendment of the Constitution. Now, there are... I know people will say, wait a minute, you've got states' rights and states' laws, and you can't talk out of the both sides of your mouth when you talk about gun laws. And you're correct, because I'll say, well, this is not correct. But in the United States, the Constitution is the law of the land, not the Supreme Court opinions, but the Constitution is. And the states, by virtue of being part of the United States, are subjugated to the Constitution. Now, I'm not saying this necessarily politically, technically accurately, but that's the general idea. All right. Now, you can go outside of the Constitution and exert states' rights, but in this case, when you've got just imagine if that was applied to freedom of speech with the internet, for example. If your signal, if they applied that same issue with freedom of speech, how would they, so would you be guilty of freedom of speech? And this is going to be taking place.
Well, think about the 100 miles within the
correct
border.
That's another issue. Yeah. Yep.
Or a large political event where they have the these zones that they set up, free speech zones, or
yep.
Freedom zones, or whatever you want to call them.
No, non-constitutional zones.
Yeah. I mean, they have basically, just like our, you know, when I say our Constitution doesn't apply, it's because we're under Emergency War Powers Act. That's what we're operating under. And when we have the, RNCs or the DNCs that come to different cities, they set up, or other political events like the inaugurations and anything that has to do with a person who is protected by Secret Service, they set up these zones where
it goes beyond Secret Service.
Right.
I mean, Secret Service
is just... I mean, that's where
just,
it started.
Correct. You have now the create... And we have to be very wary of this, because this can change on a dime, these zones. But getting back to the gun issue, this gun issue is other states could pull their reciprocity as well, and we could go back to the way it was. The bottom line on this is what we need to see, and I believe this to be the case, is we need to see the grassroots movements for concealed carry as well as open carry or firearm, whatever groups represent those legal firearm carriers. We need to see them come together and really make it difficult for Virginia and other states who do not recognize the Second Amendment as it stands. Because the reason I say this is, as we go down this road toward this mass alien invasion, folks, it's going to be your daughters, it's going to be your wives that will be targets of rape and violence. It's going to be you that are, you're going to be stripped of your rights to carry a gun. And if that's okay with you, well, I'm sorry, it shouldn't be, because you need to defend those who need defending. But that's the ultimate end of this. So if that's why I think it's important to everybody.
Yeah, meanwhile, DHS warns ISIS Trojan horse coming to America. Homeland Security Jay Johnson says that terrorists may affiliate or infiltrate America's Syrian refugee program.
May?
He's quick on the ball. Huh.
Welcome to the party, Jay.
We do have to be concerned about the possibility that a terrorist organization may seek to exploit a refugee resettlement process. Homeland Secretary Jay Johnson told reporters of Washington, D.C., this is true of this country. This is true of every other country that accepts refugees. And it gets into some statistics.
It's not accepting them. It's getting them rammed up down their throat and up their butts.
Came prior to a Fox News report that more than 102,000 Syrians have become legal permanent U.S. residents since 2012. And the U.S. has also revoked more than 122,000 foreign national visas since 2001, including 9,500 because of terrorist threats. Now, it goes on to talk about different, you know, ways of citizenship from green cards to marriage, but they talk about in the Syrian refugee of today, we should see the Jewish refugee of World War II, Obama told 31 new Americans at the National Archives.
New taxi drivers, right? Sorry.
But
I didn't say that.
I mean,
Erica Tech just...
When I first read this headline to you, DHS warns ISIS Trojan horse is coming to America. He said, yeah, that's already here and done.
Right.
So...
Well...
And yes, I mean, that's just...
All right.
Obama administration will veto counterterrorism measure to save nuclear deal with Iran. Now, this is a very interesting story. I don't know if you read this or saw this. Secretary of State John Kerry is working to reassure Iranian leaders that recent congressional efforts to tighten counterterrorism measures will not harm Iranian interests, according to a letter sent by Kerry to Iran's foreign minister. The assurances come following efforts by Congress to tighten restrictions on the visa waiver program, which they claim has gaping loopholes that may enable suspected terrorists to legally enter the U.S. with few background checks. Iranian leaders expressed anger over the move in recent days, prompting senior Obama administration officials
terrorists.
Convey
can't get
their own...
past that. Go ahead.
Kerry wrote to the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, last week, promising that the Obama administration could veto these new counterterrorism laws in order to ensure Iran is not negatively impacted.
Well,
I want to confirm to you that we remain fully committed to the sanctions lifting provided under the nuclear deal, Kerry wrote. We will adhere to the full measure of our commitments per the agreement. Our team is working hard to be prepared. As soon as we reach implementation day, we will lift appropriate sanctions. Kerry vowed to ignore new counterterrorism measures if they impact the administration's ability to uphold the Iranian nuclear deal. And the Iranian deal has already allowed Iran to break international law and violate the nuclear agreement by testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. It says the nuclear deal allows Iran to test ballistic missiles in violation of international law, but it does not allow Congress to prevent terrorists from coming to the United States.
Right.
It's American politics for you.
And, you know, as serious as the geopolitical situation with Iran is, and it's serious, you've got Russia, Iran, Syria, this alliance over there, and Iran's part of it, okay? We're going to be getting into more of this. In fact, I might do a little news segment about this, or a little explanation segment outside of the show on this, and write some articles about this, because I think it's so important. But because of the time that we're looking at right now, you know, we're being, folks, we are being conditioned. There's this social engineering taking place. Now, I got an email when the senator was talking. I got an email from a listener who's saying, you know, enough of the Nazi stuff already. You're making me ill. It's enough. And there was even a kind of a question in there. Why are you obsessed with it? And the answer to that is real simple. It's kind of now finding, at least in my view, finding this Rubik's, or this answer, finding an answer to questions. When you've got a bunch of points out there, when you've got a bunch of conspiracy points out there that, that seem like disparate events, separate events, and there's nothing that seemingly connects these events, and communism doesn't quite fit. Fascism does, but even more precisely, Nazism does. That's when it gets my interest, because I'm like a bulldog, at least I think I am. When I'm on an investigation, if I see something and there's a clue out there or a piece of evidence out there, I'm going to chase after that until I get all the meat off the bone, or until, you know, whatever happens. The social conditioning that we are being forced into here in this country, in America, and all throughout the West, is key. Is extremely important. It's key to us accepting World War III. It's key to us accepting the events over in Syria and Ukraine and elsewhere. It's key to getting people to go volunteer to help the Russians fight the United States, fight against the United States in favor of Syria. It's key with the Palestinian and Israeli conflict. It's key domestically. It's a key factor in the civil war that's coming in America. It all goes back to an ideology that was really birthed from the Tavistock Institute. And I'm probably going to get an email saying, I'm tired of you talking about Tavistock Institute. What the heck? But to understand really what's going on today, it is the Tavistock Institute who instituted steps to create a fascist political order in this country. To the extent now where we're seeing where it's currently discrimination to refer to a transgender woman by a male pronoun in New York City. I don't know whether you saw this from Reuters.
A transgendered woman is a man, right?
Okay. Well, I think.
Because we have the... Bruce Jenner is a man.
Well, I don't know.
Despite winning the Glamour magazine Woman of the Year, despite having his name changed,
Bruce Jenner is a freak.
He was born a man. He's a man.
I don't know. Is there a box for freak?
So is it? Are you saying it is?
I mean,
what'd you say it was? What?
Okay.
To call. I call Bruce Jenner a man, even though he now considers himself a girl, like that story we saw last week where a 56-year-old man with six kids abandoned his whole family to become a 6-year-old girl and had found two adoptive parents, older people, to treat him like a baby. Now, because this 56-year-old man feels like a baby, there's no political correctness and insanity. I mean...
Well, there's no sanity in political correctness. How's
either
that?
Either way, yeah. I mean, I cannot have...
But okay, well, let me just tell you about this New York City deal here, because the city has warned landlords and employers and businesses. So if you're listening to this in New York City, the five boroughs there, and you're a landlord, and you say, there's a guy... Well, a former guy turns himself into a woman, and you call him him or mister when she prefers female title and pronoun. Or if you bar her from using, or him from, or it, or the freak, or the... We have to figure out a name for these, but anyway, to use the women's restroom, you could be in legal trouble. You see, new guidelines are detailing the legal protections of transgendered and gender nonconforming. Listen to that. What the hell is that? Gender nonconforming. What kind of sick society? You know what? Any kind, man, if you're out there and you're okay with gender nonconforming, I want to just... I think Eric just hit the button to shut me off. No, sorry, you're a freak. You're a freak. We're going to be back with Stan Dale with some sanity coming right back.
At least you're confused.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.